Chapter 3. Why Can't Johnny Kill? Why did individual soldiers over hundreds of years refuse to kill the enemy, even when they knew that doing so would endanger their own lives? And why, if this has been so throughout history, have we not been fully aware of it? Many veteran hunters, upon hearing accounts of non-firers, might say, aha, buck fever. And they would be quite right. But what is buck fever? And why do men experience during the hunt that inability to kill that we call buck fever? We must turn back to S.L.A. Marshall for the answer. Marshall studied this issue during the entire period of World War II. He, more than any other individual prior to him, understood the thousands of soldiers who did not fire at the enemy, and he concluded that the average and healthy individual has such an inner and usually unrealized resistance towards killing his fellow man that he will not, of his own volition, take life if it is possible to turn away from that responsibility. At the vital point, says Marshall, the soldier becomes a conscientious objector. Marshall understood the mechanics and emotions of combat. He was a combat veteran of World War I, asking the combat veterans of World War II about their responses to battle. And he understood. He had been there. I well recall, said Marshall, the great sense of relief that came to World War I troops when they were passed to a quiet sector. And he believed that this was due not so much to the realization that things were safer there, as to the blessed knowledge that for a time they were not under the compulsion to take life. In his experience, that philosophy of the World War I soldier was, let him go. We'll get him some other time. Dyer also studied the matter carefully, building his knowledge on those who knew, and he too understood, that men will kill under compulsion. Men will do almost anything if they know it is expected of them and they're under strong social pressure to comply. But the vast majority of men are not born killers. The U.S. Army Air Corps, now the U.S. Air Force, ran head-on into this problem when it discovered that during World War II, less than 1% of their fighter pilots accounted for 30 to 40% of all enemy aircraft destroyed in the air. And according to Gabriel, most fighter pilots never shot anyone down or even tried to. Some suggest that simple fear was the force that prevented these men from killing. But these pilots usually flew in small groups led by proven killers who took the non-killers into dangerous situations, and these men bravely followed. But when it came time to kill, they looked into the cockpit at another man, a pilot, a flyer, one of the Brotherhood of the Air, a man frighteningly like themselves. And when faced with such a man, it is possible that the vast majority simply could not kill him. The pilots of both fighter and bomber aircraft faced the terrible dilemma of air combat against others of their own kind. And this was a significant factor in making their task difficult. The matter of the mechanics of killing in air battles and the U.S. Air Force's remarkable discoveries in attempting to pre-select killers for pilot training are addressed later in this study. That the average man will not kill, even at the risk of all he holds dear, has been largely ignored by those who attempt to understand the psychological and sociological pressures of the battlefield. Looking another human being in the eye, making an independent decision to kill him, and watching as he dies due to your action, combine to form the single most basic, important, primal, and potentially traumatic occurrence of war. If we understand this, then we understand the magnitude of the horror of killing in combat. The Israeli military psychologist Ben Shalit, in his book The Psychology of Conflict and Combat, referring to Marshall studies, says that it is clear that many soldiers do not shoot directly at the enemy. Many reasons are given, one of them which, oddly enough, is not often discussed, may be the reluctance of the individual to act in a direct aggressive way. Why is this not often discussed? If Johnny can't kill, if the average soldier will not kill unless coerced and conditioned and provided with mechanical and mental leverage, then why has it not been understood before? British Field Marshal Evelyn Woods said that in war only cowards need lie. I believe that to call the men who did not fire in combat cowards is grossly inaccurate. But those who did not fire do indeed have something to hide, or at the very least, something that they would not be very proud of and would readily lie about in later years. The point is that, one, an intense, traumatic, guilt-laden situation will inevitably result in a web of forgetfulness, deception, and lies. Two, Such situations that continue for thousands of years become institutions based on a tangled web of individual and cultural forgetfulness, deception, and lies, tightly woven over thousands of years. And three, for the most part, there have been two such institutions about which the male ego has always justified selective memory, self-deception, and lying. These two institutions are sex and combat, love and war. For thousands of years, we did not understand human sexuality. We understood the big things about sex. We knew that it made babies, and it worked. But we had no idea how human sexuality affected the individual. Until the studies of human sexuality by Sigmund Freud and researchers of the 20th century, we had not even begun to really understand the role that sex played in our lives. For thousands of years, we did not truly study sex and therefore had no hope of ever understanding it. The very fact that in studying sex, we were studying ourselves, made impartial observation difficult. Sex was especially difficult to study because so much of the ego and self-esteem of each individual was invested in this area full of myths and misunderstanding. If someone was impotent or frigid, would he or she let that be common knowledge? If the majority of the marriages of two centuries ago suffered problems with impotence or frigidity, would we have known? An educated man of 200 years ago would have probably said, they manage to make plenty of babies, don't they? They must be doing something right. And if 100 years ago a researcher discovered that sexual abuse of children was rampant in society, how would such a discovery be treated? Freud made just such a discovery, and he was personally disgraced and professionally scorned by his peers and by society at large for even suggesting such a thing. It is only today, over a century later, that we have begun to accept and address the magnitude of sexual abuse of children in our society. Until someone with authority and credibility asked the individuals in privacy and with dignity, we had no hope of ever realizing what was actually occurring sexually in our culture. And even under such circumstances, society as a whole has to be sufficiently prepared and enlightened in order to throw off the blinders that limit its ability to perceive itself. In the same way that we did not understand what was occurring in the bedroom, we have not understood what was occurring on the battlefield. Our ignorance of the destructive act matched that of the procreative act. If a soldier would not kill in combat, when it was his duty and responsibility to do so, would he let that be common knowledge? And if the majority of soldiers 200 years ago did not fulfill their duties on the battlefield, would we have known? A general of the era would probably have said, they managed to kill plenty of people, don't they? They won the war for us, didn't they? They must be doing something right. Until SLA Marshall asked the individuals involved immediately after the fact, we had no hope of understanding what was occurring on the battlefield. Philosophers and psychologists have long been aware of man's basic inability to perceive that which is closest to him. Sir Norman Angell tells us that it is quite in keeping with man's curious intellectual history that the simplest and most important questions are those he asks least often. And the philosopher-soldier Glenn Gray speaks from personal experiences in World War II when he observed that few of us can hold on to our real selves long enough to discover the real truths about ourselves and this whirling earth to which we cling. This is especially true, observed Gray, of men in war. The great god Mars tries to blind us when we enter his realm, and when we leave, he gives us a generous cup of the waters of Lethe to drink. If a professional soldier were to see through the fog of his own self-deception, and if he were to face the cold reality that he can't do what he has dedicated his life to, or that many of his soldiers would rather die than do their duty, it would make his life a lie. Such a man would be apt to deny his weakness with all the energy he could muster. No, the soldiers are not apt to write of their failures or the failures of their men. With few exceptions, it is only the heroes and the glory that make their way into print. Part of the reason for our lack of knowledge in this area is that combat is, like sex, laden with a baggage of expectations and myth. A belief that most soldiers will not kill the enemy in close combat is contrary to what we want to believe about ourselves. It is contrary to what thousands of years of military history and culture have told us. But are the perceptions handed down to us by our culture and our historians accurate, unbiased, and reliable? In A History of Militarism, Alfred Rachts, accuses military history as an institution of having played a large part in the process of militarizing minds. Vogts complains that military history is consistently written with polemic purpose for the justification of individuals or armies, and with small regard for socially relevant facts. He states, "A very large part of military history is written, if not for the express purpose of supporting an army's authority, at least with the intention of not hurting it, not revealing its secrets, avoiding the betrayal of weakness, vacillation, or distemper." Vogts paints an image of military and historical institutions that for thousands of years have reinforced and supported each other in a process of mutual glorification and aggrandizement. To a certain extent, this is probably because those who are good at killing in war are quite often those who throughout history have hacked their way to power. The military and the politicians have been the same people for all but the most recent part of human history, and we know that the victor writes the history books. As a historian, as a soldier, and as a psychologist, I believe that Vogts is quite correct. If for thousands of years the vast majority of soldiers secretly and privately were less than enthused about killing their fellow man on the battlefield, the professional soldiers and their chroniclers would be the last to let us know the inadequacies of their particular charges. The media in our modern information society has done much to perpetuate the myth of easy killing, and have thereby become part of society's unspoken conspiracy of deception that glorifies killing in war. There are exceptions, such as Gene Hackman's Bat 2-1, in which an Air Force pilot has to kill people on the ground, up close and personal for a change, and is horrified at what he has done. But for the most part, we are given James Bond, Luke Skywalker, Rambo, and Indiana Jones, blithely and remorselessly killing men by the hundreds. The point here is that there is as much disinformation and as little insight concerning the nature of killing coming from the media as from any other aspect of our society. Even after Marshall's World War II revelations, the subject of non-firearms is an uncomfortable one for today's military. Writing in Army Magazine, the U.S. Army's foremost military journal, Colonel Mader states that his experiences as an infantry company commander in World War II strongly supports Marshall's findings, and noted several World War I anecdotes that suggest that the problem of non-firearms was just as serious in that war. Mader then bitterly and appropriately complains that, "Thinking back over my many years of service, I cannot remember a single official lecture or class discussion on how to assure that your men will fire." This included such formal schooling as the Wartime Infantry Leadership and Battle School I attended in Italy, and the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, that I attended in 1966. Nor do I remember any articles on the subject in Army Magazine or other military publications. Colonel Mader concludes, "It is as if there were a conspiracy of silence around this subject. We don't know what to do about it, so let's forget it." There does indeed seem to be a conspiracy of silence on this subject. In his book War on the Mind, Peter Watson observes that Marshall's findings have been largely ignored by academia and the fields of psychology and psychiatry, but they were very much taken to heart by the U.S. Army, and a number of training measures were instituted as a result of Marshall's suggestions. According to studies by Marshall, these changes resulted in a firing rate of 55% in Korea, and according to a study by R.W. Glenn, a 90 to 95% firing rate was attained in Vietnam. Some modern soldiers use the disparity between the firing rates of World War II and Vietnam to claim that Marshall had to be wrong, for the average military leader had great difficulty in believing that any significant body of his soldiers will not do their job in combat. But these doubters don't give sufficient credit to the revolutionary corrective measures and training methods introduced since World War II. The training methods that increase the firing rate from 15% to 90% are referred to as programming or conditioning by some of the veterans I've interviewed, and they do appear to represent a form of classical and operant conditioning, a la Pavlov's dog and B.F. Skinner's rats, which is addressed in detail in the section on killing in Vietnam. The unpleasantness of this subject, combined with the remarkable success of the Army's training programs and the lack of official recognition, might imply that it is classified. But there is no secret master plan responsible for the lack of attention given to this subject. There is, instead, in the words of philosopher-psychologist Peter Mann, a massive unconscious cover-up in which society hides itself from the true nature of combat. Even among the psychological and psychiatric literature on war, there is, writes Mann, a kind of madness at work, he notes. Repugnance towards killing and the refusal to kill are referred to as acute combat reaction, and psychological trauma resulting from slaughter and atrocity are called stress, as if the clinicians are talking about an executive's overwork. As a psychologist, I believe that Mann is quite correct when he observes nowhere in the psychiatric and psychological literature is one allowed to glimpse what is actually occurring, the real horror of the war and its effect on those who fought it. It would be almost impossible to keep something of this nature classified for more than 50 years now. And those in the military who do understand, the marshals and the majors, are crying out their messages, but no one wants to hear their truths. No, it is not a military conspiracy. There is indeed a cover-up and a conspiracy of silence, but it's a cultural conspiracy of forgetfulness, distortion, and lies that has been going on for thousands of years. And just as we have begun to wipe away the cultural conspiracy of guilt and silence concerning sex, we must now wipe away this similar conspiracy that obscures the very nature of war.